Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. Addressing important environmental challenges like climate change while improving human well-being is a growing theme in urban development worldwide. To chat about how this can be achieved, I'm joined by Radhika Khosla, who is an urban climatologist. She's based at the Oxford Smith School of Enterprise and the Environment at the UK's University of Oxford. And she's also the new editor-in-chief of the journal Environmental Research Letters. Radhika joins me down the line from Oxford. Welcome to the podcast. And to start things off, can you tell us a bit about the field of urban climatology and the research that you do at Oxford?
Yes, so urban climatology is a study of urban climate, and it examines the interactions between the natural environment and the built environment within urban spaces. So the work that I did many years ago was looking at these interactions, particularly with the built environment and how heat gets transferred from outside the built environment into indoor built environments, starting with the city of Chicago, which is a very dense urban space. And this work has gained a lot of traction over the years as extreme heat rises around the world. My work has also evolved to ask a more broad question, a question that is quite fundamental in our time, which is how can societies improve human well-being while preserving and enhancing the environment? So this is examining this question of, you know, how when we have productive tensions between energy consumption in cities, because cities are sites where we bring together infrastructure and people and therefore have high energy demand. And often cities are also sites of transitions. One of the largest trends globally is that of urbanization. More than 80% of the world is going to be living in cities in a few decades. And cities are also sites of climate change impacts and opportunities. So examining these interactions and tensions and opportunities between energy consumption, urban transitions, and climate change in the context of development is where my work lies today.
You're currently involved with Oxford's Future of Cooling program, which looks at how we can keep people cool as the earth warms. What are the main challenges when it comes to cooling?
So I think cooling is a very exciting and understudied issue globally. It's been quite a blind spot in our sustainability debates, and it's sort of crept up on us in the last few years in particular. Of all climate change impacts, extreme heat kills more than any other. So it is in what we call a silent killer, because you often don't see the destruction that extreme heat provides. And the response to extreme heat is to be able to cool and to keep ourselves thermally comfortable. But the challenge in many ways is that our go-to solution for cooling, which is the standard air conditioner, is one that actually exacerbates the same problem that it's trying to solve, because it is often relying on a highly fossil fuel based grid. It's a very highly energy consuming device, and it uses refrigerant gases and releases carbon emissions from the grid that further exacerbate global warming and then provide more extreme heat that we need further cooling from. So our work in general is to be able to both understand and shape the future trajectory of global cooling demand. An interesting statistic from the IEA is that 10 new air conditioners will be bought every second for the next 30 years globally. And the energy demand from cooling at the end of this century is going to be much larger than that from heating. So there is a sort of inflection point that we're in the midst of. But what that means is that there are huge opportunities to shift the system of cooling and how we provide resilience from and to extreme heat globally, particularly to vulnerable populations. And our work examines both the social and the technical dimensions of doing this.
So does that mean that you're looking at, for example, passive or more passive techniques of cooling buildings rather than the sort of conventional compressed refrigeration systems?
Yes, very much so. Passive cooling techniques are really at the heart of how we can provide sustainable cooling across countries, cultures, and communities. But their provision at scale is not straightforward. So we're looking at ways and means to be able to do that. We also examine other alternative technologies and also examine how the standard vapor compression-based air conditioner can be made more efficient through higher energy efficiency standards. That's the technical side. There's also a lot of work that we do on the policy side, examining and working, for instance, with the UK Environment Audit Committee on understanding how the UK can build a heat resilience plan for its communities and vulnerable populations. But then there are also many other dimensions to this, including the links with behaviors and cultures, with business models, and with infrastructure development as a whole.
And on cooling, I mean, one of the, one of the big trends in the United States, for example, over the past 40 or 50 years is you know, the growth of the southern states, where previously, it was just too hot to, have a comfortable life in a place like Houston or Atlanta or Phoenix. But now there's millions of people living there thanks to air conditioning. And of course, that's resulting in huge carbon emissions. Will countries have to start thinking about where people live and maybe saying, well, we shouldn't be encouraging people to live in a place like Phoenix because that's going to cause, it's just going to cost too much energy and it's not going to be viable.
Yeah, I think Lee Kuan Yew, the founder of modern Singapore, said it best when he said that civilization was made possible in the tropics because of air conditioning. And, that's very much the same rationale behind these entire belts in the Middle East, in the southern states of the United States, which are very, very hot regions where we have thriving communities because of air conditioning. But like you're saying, these are also hotspots in many ways where, as global temperatures rise, particularly as we move towards a 1.5 degree world and possibly a world that is even warmer than that, the level of extreme heat in terms of its intensity, duration, and frequency is just going to rise. So we did some work which was published and gained quite a lot of traction last year, which showed that if the world warms from 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels to 2 degrees, then the largest relative increase, or the largest absolute increase first from cooling degree days, which is an indicator of extreme heat, happens in countries in Africa. So, the top 10 countries are all in Africa where you're going to see the largest absolute increase, but the largest relative increase from a 1.5 to a 2 degree world in cooling degree days is actually countries in Northern Europe. So the UK, Switzerland, Ireland, Norway. And these are places that are traditionally unprepared for heat. So it's not just these warmer climates that we, where we expect these kinds of changes. It's actually a number of cooler climates which have not traditionally grappled with these issues at all that are going to have to very quickly learn to adapt and build resilience.
And you're also a research director at the Oxford India Center for Sustainable Development, which currently has 21 scholars from India working in Oxford. Can you talk a bit about the research that they're doing?
Yes, so the Oxford India Center for Sustainable Development is one of the few centers around the world, actually, which focuses on contemporary India and its sustainable development opportunities and challenges. India is very—it's very instructive in many ways because it is where the largest urban transition in history is happening at the moment, and it is, sort of full of opportunities and challenges in terms of how we move forward towards sustainability for energy and climate change, but a number of other issues. So the center focuses on these contemporary problems. It takes an interdisciplinary view, not privileging one discipline over the other. So, you know, there is work that takes place at one end from antibiotic resistance to the development of photovoltaic cells, to the electric vehicle transition in India, to the preservation of biodiversity in different natural habitats, and to the use of law and regulation in managing these transitions. So it's a very diverse and rich and vibrant place where we're trying to build the linkages between these multiple, both sort of, you know, the multiple transitions that are taking place in the country, the multiple opportunities that come out of these transitions, but also the challenges, particularly those that come from, you know, being in the context of development and having the sort of state capacity that the country does.
So you're also a research associate at Oxford's Zero Institute. What are the aims of that institute?
The Zero Institute, which stands for Zero Carbon Energy Research Oxford, is a new and exciting institute and initiative that has been set up strategically by the University of Oxford. And its primary motivation is to get the zero carbon energy system right. The reason for this is that over 70% of greenhouse gases that are responsible for global warming come from the conversion and the use of energy. So we recognize that there's no way to make the transition towards the net zero goals that many countries have and the overall global net zero goal that we need to achieve for addressing climate change without taking a very hard look and finding solutions to the energy system. And so this institute really brings together all the thinking in Oxford in terms of how do we transition to a zero carbon energy system to establish a stable climate. So it is multidisciplinary. It examines questions such as energy demand, which have traditionally been quite sort of ignored in the energy discourse because we've had a focus on supply for a long time. But here we really focus on both demand and supply, but also conversion and storage and distribution, and both the socio-technical links that are required to be able to make these transitions, including the links to other sustainable development goals and the links to achieving a net zero goal more broadly. But its remit as such is to focus on the energy question and to say, how do we tackle all sectors that contribute to energy across scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions?
And you've also just taken over as the new editor-in-chief of the journal Environmental Research Letters. What are your plans for the journal?
Yes, it's really a privilege to be able to be in this position and to follow the big footsteps of Dan, who was in this role for so many years before me. And part of the plan, in some sense, is to continue all the work that the journal has already been doing, and you know the flagship publication that it produces that I've been reading for so many years now. There are three things in particular that I am interested in focusing on. The first is to build greater collaboration between the physical, natural, and social sciences. And this stems out of my own approach to research problems and to climate change and energy questions in particular, which is that, you know, we can no longer take a purely disciplinary lens to these issues. Interdisciplinarity is really important, but doing interdisciplinarity in a way that honors the depth of different disciplines is really key. So to build research that allows for that kind of depth and breadth across disciplinary spaces in the physical sciences, in the natural sciences, and in the social sciences, but keeping justice also at the core of these issues is going to be really important. A second issue is to focus on creating new and stronger networks with authors, researchers, institutions, and communities in the Global South, and really encourage work from countries that are not often represented in our research landscape, and particularly countries that are in the midst of so many multiple transitions that hold the key to both lessons and opportunities for how we make these shifts in our global climate and in our environmental systems more broadly. And then the third is to be able to support and champion early career researchers who, again, often don't have spaces to be able to put their work forward, but to be able to give them a space and to be able to also provide them with ways and means and approaches to be able to enhance and take their work forward to the next level.
Well, that sounds like a great plan for the journal. And I should say that Environmental Research Letters is published by Institute of Physics Publishing, which also brings you Physics World. And you can find it on the IOP Science website. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to talk with you.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Radhika Khosla for joining me today, and a special thanks to our producer, Fred Isles. We'll be back again next week, but in the meantime, do check out the latest episode of the Physics World Stories podcast. Host Andrew Glester looks at theories of modified gravity, which seek to explain the large-scale structure of the universe without the need for dark matter. His guests are modified gravity advocate Stacy McGaugh of the Case Western Reserve University in the U.S. and dark matter enthusiast Indranil Banik, who is at the U.K.'s University of St. Andrews. That episode is called Dark Matter versus Modified Gravity, Which Team Are You On? And you can find it on the Physics World website or at your favorite podcast provider.
Physics World.